But as if the gods themselves wanted to test him, a gust of rain-cooled wind sprayed into their faces, and some sense pricked in its wake. A shift in the air. Like a great pocket of power gathered close, beckoning. The knife at his side was instantly in his soaked hand as he searched the rooftops, revealing only plumes of rain. Rowan quieted his mind, listening to the city and storm around them. Dorian swept his dripping hair out of his face, mouth open to speak, until he noted the knife.
"You feel it too."
Rowan nodded, rain sliding down his nose.
"What do you sense?"
The king's raw power might pick up different feelings, different clues, than what his wind and ice and instinct could detect. But without the training, it might not be clear.
"It feels old."
Dorian winced and said over the storm,
"Feral. Ruthless. I can't glean anything more."
"Does it remind you of the Volg?"
If there was one person who'd know, it'd be the king before him.
"No,"
Dorian said, gaze shuddering.
"They were abhorrent to my magic. This thing out there, it just makes my magic curious. Wary, but curious. But it's concealed. Somehow."
Rowan sheathed his knife.
"Then stay close, and keep alert."
Dorian had never been in such a place as Skull's Bay. Even with the heavy rain lashing them, as they hunted the source of—
"Take some of this weight off my chest. I don't want all those clothes. Let me alone. Let me alone. It's not fair. It's not fair. What enormous blue bottles. They say you get used to them." And then it would end in the canine howl. Ransom never could make up his mind whether it was a trick or whether a decaying psychic energy that had once been Western were indeed fitfully and miserably alive within the body that sat there beside him. He discovered that any hatred he had once felt for the professor was dead. He found it natural to pray fervently for his soul. Yet what he felt for Weston was not exactly pity. Up till that moment, whenever he had thought of hell, he had pictured the lost souls as being still human. Now, as the frightful abyss which parts ghosthood from manhood yawned before him, pity was almost swallowed up in horror, in the unconquerable revulsion of the life within him from positive and self-consuming death. If the remains of Weston were, at such moments, speaking through the lips of the unman, then Weston was not now a man at all. The forces which had begun, perhaps years ago, to eat away his humanity, had now completed their work. The intoxicated will which had been slowly poisoning the intelligence and the affections had now at last poisoned itself, and the whole psychic organism had fallen to pieces. Only a ghost was left. An everlasting unrest, a crumbling, a ruin, an odor of decay. And this, thought Ransom, might be my destination, or hers. But of course the hours spent alone with the unman were like hours in a back area. The real business of life was the interminable conversation between the tempter and the green lady. Taken hour by hour, the progress was hard to estimate. But as the days passed, Ransom could not resist the conviction that the general development was in the enemy's favour. There were, of course, ups and downs. Often the unman was unexpectedly repulsed by some simplicity which it seemed not to have anticipated. Often, too, Ransom's own contributions to the terrible debate were, for the moment, successful. There were times when he thought, "Thank God we've won at last." But the enemy was never tired, and Ransom grew more weary all the time. And presently he thought he could see signs that the lady was becoming tired, too. In the end he taxed her with it and begged her to send them both away, but she rebuked him, and her rebuke revealed how dangerous the situation had already become. "Shall I go and rest and play?" she asked, "while all this lies on our hands? Not till I am certain that there is no great deed to be done by me for the king and for the children of our children." It was on those lines that the enemy now worked almost exclusively. Though the lady had no word for duty, he had made it appear to her in the light of a duty that she should continue to fondle the idea of disobedience, and convinced her that it would be a cowardice if she repulsed him. The ideas of the great deed, of the great risk, of a kind of martyrdom were presented to her every day, varied in a thousand forms. The notion of waiting to ask the king before a decision was made had been unobtrusively shuffled aside. Any such cowardice was now not to be thought of. The whole point of her action, the whole grandeur, would lie in taking it without the king's knowledge, in leaving him utterly free to repudiate it, so that all the benefits should be his and all the risks hers. And with the risk, of course, all the magnanimity, the pathos, the tragedy, and the originality. And also, the tempter hinted, it would be no use asking the king, for he would certainly not approve the action. Men were like that. The king must be forced to be free. Now, while she was on her own, now or never, the noble thing must be achieved. And with that now or never, he began to play on a fear which the lady apparently shared with the women of Earth, the fear that life might be wasted, some great opportunity let slip. "How if I were as a tree that could have borne gourds, and yet bore none?" she said. Ransom tried to convince her that children were fruit enough. But the young man asked whether this elaborate division of the human race into two sexes could possibly be meant for no other purpose than offspring, a matter which might have been more simply provided for, as it was in many of the plants. A moment later it was explaining that men like Ransom in his own world, men of that intensely male and backward-looking type who always shrank away from the new good, had continuously laboured to keep women down to mere childbearing, and to ignore the high destiny for which Maleldil had actually created her. It told her that such men had already done incalculable harm. Let her look to it that nothing of the sort happened on Perelandra. It was at this stage that it began to teach her many new words, words like creative and intuition and spiritual. But that was one of its false steps. When she had at last been made to understand what creative meant, she forgot all about the great risk and the tragic loneliness, and laughed for a whole minute on end. Finally, she told the young man that it was younger even than Piebald, and sent them both away. Ransom gained ground over that, but on the following day he lost it all by losing his temper. The enemy had been pressing on her with more than usual ardour the nobility of self-sacrifice and self-dedication, and the enchantment seemed to be deepening in her mind every moment, when Ransom, goaded beyond all patience, had leaped to his feet and really turned upon her, talking far too quickly and almost shouting, and even forgetting his old solar and intermixing English words. He tried to tell her that he'd seen this kind of unselfishness in action, to tell her of women making themselves sick with hunger rather than begin the meal before the man of the house returned, though they knew perfectly well that there was nothing he disliked more. Of mothers wearing themselves to a ravelling to marry some daughter to a man whom she detested, of Agrippina and of Lady Macbeth. "Can you not see," he shouted, "that he is making you say words that mean nothing? What is the good of saying you would do this for the king's sake when you know it is what the king would hate most? Are you Maleldil that you should determine what is good for the king?" But she understood only a very small part of what he said, and was bewildered by his manner. The young man made capital out of this speech. But through all these ups and downs, all changes of the front line, all counter-attacks and stands and withdrawals, Ransom came to see more and more clearly the strategy of the whole affair. The lady's response to the suggestion of becoming a risk-bearer, a tragic pioneer, was still a response made chiefly out of her love for the king and for her unborn children, and even, in a sense, of Maleldil himself. The idea that he might not really wish to be obeyed to the letter was the sluice through which the whole flood of suggestion had been admitted to her mind. But mixed with this response, from the moment when the unman began its tragic stories, there was the faintest touch of theatricality, the first hint of a self-admiring inclination to seize a grand role in the drama of her world. It was clear that the unman's whole effort was to increase this element. As long as this was but one drop, so to speak, in the sea of her mind, he would not really succeed. Perhaps, while it remained so, she was protected from actual disobedience. Perhaps no rational creature, until such a motive became dominant, could really throw away happiness for anything quite so vague as the tempter's chatter about deeper life and the upward path. The veiled egoism in the conception of noble revolt must be increased. And, Ransom thought, despite many rallies on her part and many setbacks suffered by the enemy, that it was, very slowly and yet perceptibly, increasing. The matter was, of course, cruelly, cruelly complicated. What the unman said was always very nearly true. Certainly it must be part of the divine plan that this happy creature should mature, should become more and more a creature of free choice, should become, in a sense, more distinct from God and from her husband in order thereby to be at one with them in a richer fashion. In fact, he had seen this very process going on from the moment at which he met her, and had, unconsciously, assisted it. This present temptation, if conquered, would itself be the next and greatest step in the same direction. An obedience freer, more reasoned, more conscious than any she had known before was being put in her power. But for that very reason, the fatal false step which, once taken, would thrust her down into the terrible slavery of appetite and hate and economics and government, which our race knows so well, could be made to sound so like the true one. What made him feel sure that the dangerous element in her interest was growing was her progressive disregard of the plain intellectual bones of the problem. It became harder to recall her mind to the data, a command from Maleldil, a complete uncertainty about the results of breaking it, and a present happiness so great that hardly any change could be for the better. The turgid swell of indistinctly splendid images which the unman aroused, and the transcendent importance of the central image, carried all this away. She was still in her innocence. No evil intention had been formed in her mind. But if her will was uncorrupted, half her imagination was already filled with bright, poisonous shapes. "This can't go on," thought Ransom for the second time. But all his arguments proved in the long run unavailing, and it did go on. There came a night when he was so tired that towards morning he fell into a leaden sleep and slept far into the following day. He woke to find himself alone. A great horror came over him. "What could I have done? What could I have done?" he cried out, for he thought that all was lost. With sick heart and sore head he staggered to the edge of the island. His idea was to find a fish and to pursue the truants to the fixed land, where he felt little doubt that they had gone. In the bitterness and confusion of his mind, he forgot that he had no notion in which direction that land now lay, nor how far it was distant. Hurrying through the woods, he emerged into an open place and suddenly found that he was not alone. Two human figures, robed to their feet, stood before him, silent under the yellow sky. Their clothes were of purple and blue, their heads wore chaplets of silver leaves, and their feet were bare. They seemed to him to be, the one the ugliest, and the other the most beautiful, of the children of men. Then one of them spoke, and he realized that they were none other than the Green Lady herself and the haunted body of Weston. The robes were of feathers, and he knew well the Perelandrian birds from which they had been derived. The art of the weaving, if weaving it could be called, was beyond his comprehension.
"Welcome, Piebald," said the lady. "You have slept long. What do you think of us in our leaves?"
"The birds," said Ransom. "The poor birds. What has he done to them?"
"He has found the feathers somewhere," said the lady carelessly. "They drop them."
"Why have you done this, lady?"
"He has been making me older again. Why did you never tell me, Piebald?"
"Tell you what?"
"We never knew. This one showed me that the trees have leaves and the beasts have fur, and said that in your world the men and women also hung beautiful things about them. Why do you not tell us how we look?" "Oh, Piebald, Piebald, I hope this is not going to be another of the new goods from which you draw back your hand. It cannot be new to you if they all do it in your world."
"Ah," said Ransom, "but it is different there. It is cold."
"Or so the stranger said," she answered. "But not in all parts of your world. He says they do it even where it is warm."
"Has he said why they do it?"
"To be beautiful. Why else?"
said the lady with some wonder in her face. Thank heaven, thought Ransom, he is only teaching her vanity, for he had feared something worse. Yet could it be possible, in the long run, to wear clothes without learning modesty, and through modesty, lasciviousness?
"Do you think we are more beautiful?"
said the lady, interrupting his thoughts. "No," said Ransom, and then correcting himself, "I don't know." It was indeed not easy to reply. The young man, now that Weston's prosaic shirt and shorts were concealed, looked a more exotic and therefore a more imaginatively less squalidly hideous figure. As for the lady, that she looked in some way worse was not doubtful. Yet there is a plainness in nudity, as we speak of plain bread. A sort of richness, a flamboyancy, a concession, as it were, to lower conceptions of the beautiful had come with the purple robe. For the first and last time, she appeared to him at that moment as a woman whom an earth-born man might conceivably love. And this was intolerable. The ghastly inappropriateness of the idea had, all in one moment, stolen something from the colours of the landscape and the scent of the flowers.
"Do you think we are more beautiful?" repeated the lady.
"What does it matter?" said Ransom dully.
"Everyone should wish to be as beautiful as they can," she answered, "and we cannot see ourselves."
"We can," said Weston's body.
"How can this be?" said the lady, turning to it. "Even if you could roll your eyes right round to look inside, they would see only blackness."
"Oh, not that way," it answered. "I will show you." It walked a few paces away to where Weston's pack lay in the yellow turf. With that curious distinctness which often falls upon us when we are anxious and preoccupied, Ransom noticed the exact make and pattern of the pack. It must have been from the same shop in London where he had bought his own. And that little fact, suddenly reminding him that Weston had once been a man, that he too had once had pleasures and pains and a human mind, almost brought the tears into his eyes. The horrible fingers which Weston would never use again worked at the buckles and brought out a small, bright object, an English pocket mirror that might have cost 3 and 6. He handed it to the Green Lady. She turned it over in her hands.
"What is it? What am I to do with it?" she said.
"Look in it," said the young man.
"How?"
"Look," he said. Then taking it from her, he held it up to her face. She stared for quite an appreciable time without apparently making anything of it. Then she started back with a cry and covered her face. Ransom started too. It was the first time he had seen her the mere passive recipient of any emotion. The world about him was big with change.
"Oh, oh," she cried. "What is it? I saw a face."
"Only your own face, beautiful one," said the young man.
"I know," said the lady, still averting her eyes from the mirror. "My face, out there, looking at me. Am I growing older, or is it something else? I feel, my heart is beating too hard. I am not warm. What is it?"
She glanced from one of them to the other. The mysteries had all vanished from her face. It was as easy to read as that of a man in a shelter when a bomb is coming.
"What is it?" she repeated.
"It is called fear," said Weston's mouth. Then the creature turned its face full on Ransom and grinned.
"Fear," she said. "This is fear,"
pondering the discovery. Then, with abrupt finality,
"I do not like it."
"It will go away," said the young man, when Ransom interrupted.
"It will never go away if you do what he wishes. It is into more and more fear that he is leading you."
"It is," said the young man, "into the great waves and through them and beyond. Now that you know fear, you see that it must be you who shall taste it on behalf of your race. You know the king will not. You do not wish him to. But there is no cause for fear in this little thing, rather for joy. What is fearful in it?"
"Things being two when they are one," replied the lady decisively. "That thing," she pointed at the mirror, "is me and not me."
"But if you do not look, you will never know how beautiful you are."
"It comes into my mind, stranger," she answered, "that a fruit does not eat itself, and a man cannot be together with himself."
"A fruit cannot do that because it is only a fruit," said the young man. "But we can do it. We call this thing a mirror. A man can love himself and be together with himself. That is what it means to be a man or a woman, to walk alongside oneself as if one were a second person, and to delight in one's own beauty. Mirrors were made to teach this art."
"Is it a good?" said the lady.
"No," said Ransom. "How can you find out without trying?" said the young man.
"If you try it, and it is not good," said Ransom, "how do you know whether you will be able to stop doing it?" "I am walking alongside myself already," said the lady. but I do not yet know what I look like. If I have become two, I had better know what the other is. As for you, Piebald, one look will show me this woman's face, and why should I look more than once?"
She took the mirror timidly but firmly from the unman and looked into it in silence for the better part of a minute. Then she let it sink and stood holding it at her side.
"It is very strange," she said at last.
"It is very beautiful," said the unman. "Do you not think so?"
"Yes."
"But you have not yet found what you set out to find."
"What was that? I have forgotten."
"Whether the robe of feathers made you more beautiful or less."
"Well, I saw only a face."
"Hold it further away and you will see the whole of the alongside woman, the other who is yourself. Oh no, I will hold it." The commonplace suggestions of the scene became grotesque at this stage. She looked at herself first with the robe, then without it, then with it again. Finally, she decided against it and threw it away. The unman picked it up. "Will you not keep it?" he said. "You might wish to carry it on some days, even if you do not wish for it on all days."
"Keep it?"
she asked, not clearly understanding. "I had forgotten," said the unman. "I had forgotten that you would not live on the fixed land, nor build a house, nor in any way become mistress of your own days. Keeping means putting a thing where you know you can always find it again, and where rain and beasts and other people cannot reach it. I would give you this mirror to keep. It would be the queen's mirror, a gift brought into the world from deep heaven. The other women would not have it. But you have reminded me there can be no gifts, no keeping, no foresight while you live as you do, from day to day, like the beasts." But the lady did not appear to be listening to him. She stood like one almost dazed with the richness of a daydream. She did not look in the least like a woman who is thinking about a new dress. The expression of her face was noble. It was a great deal too noble. Greatness, tragedy, high sentiment, these were obviously what occupied her thoughts. Ransom perceived that the affair of the robes and the mirror had been only superficially concerned with what is commonly called female vanity. The image of her beautiful body had been offered to her only as a means to awake the far more perilous image of her great soul. The external and, as it were, dramatic conception of the self was the enemy's true aim. He was making her mind a theatre in which that phantom self should hold the stage. He had already written the play.
Chapter 11. Because he had slept so late that morning, Ransom found it easy to keep awake the following night. The sea had become calm, and there was no rain. He sat upright in the darkness with his back against a tree. The others were close beside him, the lady, to judge by her breathing, asleep, and the unman doubtless waiting to arouse her and resume its solicitations the moment Ransom should doze. For the third time, more strongly than ever before, it came into his head, "This can't go on." The enemy was using third-degree methods. It seemed to Ransom that, but for a miracle, the lady's resistance was bound to be worn away in the end. Why did no miracle come? Or rather, why no miracle on the right side? For the presence of the enemy was in itself a kind of miracle. Had hell a prerogative to work wonders? Why did heaven work none? Not for the first time he found himself questioning divine justice. He could not understand why Maleldil should remain absent when the enemy was there in person. But while he was thinking this, as suddenly and sharply as if the solid darkness about him had spoken with articulate voice, he knew that Maleldil was not absent. That sense, so very welcome yet never welcomed without the overcoming of a certain resistance, that sense of the presence which he had once or twice before experienced on Perelandra, returned to him. The darkness was packed quite full. It seemed to press upon his trunk so that he could hardly use his lungs. It seemed to close in on his skull like a crown of intolerable weight, so that for a space he could hardly think. Moreover, he became aware in some indefinable fashion that it had never been absent, that only some unconscious activity of his own had succeeded in ignoring it for the past few days. Inner silence is for our race a difficult achievement. There is a chattering part of the mind which continues, until it is corrected, to chatter on even in the holiest places. Thus, while one part of Ransom remained, as it were, prostrated in a hush of fear and love that resembled a kind of death, something else inside him, wholly unaffected by reverence, continued to pour queries and objections into his brain. "It's all very well," said this voluble critic, "a presence of that sort. But the enemy is really here, really saying and doing things. Where is Maleldil's representative?" The answer which came back to him, quick as a fencer's or a tennis player's riposte, out of the silence and the darkness, almost took his breath away. It seemed blasphemous. "Anyway, what can I do?" babbled the voluble self. "I've done all I can. I've talked till I'm sick of it. It's no good, I tell you." He tried to persuade himself that he, Ransom, could not possibly be Maleldil's representative, as the unman was the representative of hell. The suggestion was, he argued, itself diabolical, a temptation to fatuous pride, to megalomania. He was horrified when the darkness simply flung back this argument in his face almost impatiently. And then, he wondered how it had escaped him till now, he was forced to perceive that his own coming to Perelandra was at least as much of a marvel as the enemy's. That miracle on the right side, which he had demanded, had in fact occurred. He himself was the miracle. "Oh, but this is nonsense," said the voluble self. "He, Ransom, with his ridiculous piebald body and his 10 times defeated arguments, what sort of a miracle was that?" His mind darted hopefully down a side alley that seemed to promise escape. Very well, then. He had been brought here miraculously. He was in God's hands.
Noticed, save for those eyes. Her eyes. Behind them, the rest of the 13 and her grandmother's coven remained in the hall, only their seconds lingering in the room, as the doors were sealed again, trapping them all with the Volg King. "So," Erewhon said, looking them over in a way that had Manon clamping her lips to keep from baring her teeth. "Are the forces at the Farian Gap prepared?" Her grandmother yielded a short dip of her chin. "They move at sundown. They'll be in Rifthold 2 days after that." Manon didn't dare shift in her seat. "You're sending the host to Rifthold?" The Demon King flashed her a narrowed glance. "I am sending you to Rifthold to take back my city. When you have finished your task, the Farian Legion will be stationed there, under the command of Iskra Yellowlegs." To Rifthold. To finally fight, to see what their wyverns could do in battle. "Do they suspect the attack?" A lifeless smile. "Our forces will move too swiftly for word to reach them." No doubt why this information had been contained until now. Manon tapped a foot on the slate floor, already itching to move, to command the others in preparations. "How many of the Morath covens do I bring northward?"
"Iskra flies with the second half of our aerial legion. I would think that only a few covens from Morath would be necessary."
What she'd done that wintry night. Just hiding, forgotten by a world grateful to see such a power extinguished before it matured.
"Where is she? And how does this tie to me, lady?"
"You are versed in the history, in the players and the stakes. You know the word marks and how to wield them. You misread the riddles, thinking it was you who must come here to this place. This mirror is not the lock. It is a pool of memory, forged by myself, my father, and Rhiannon Crokin. Forged so the heir of this burden might understand one day. Know everything before deciding. This encounter, too, shall be held in it. But you were called so we might meet." That wise young face waited. "Go north, princess," Elena said. "Go into your enemy's household. Make the contacts, get the invitation, do what you must. But get to your enemy's house. The two bloodlines will converge there. Already they are on their way.
Aelin Galathinius is headed to Otterlin?
Not Aelin. Not with that name, that crown. Know her by her eyes, turquoise with a core of gold. Know her by the mark on her brow, the bastard's mark, the mark of Brannan. Guide her. Help her. She will need you.
And the price?
Elena hated them then. Hated the gods who had demanded this. Hated herself. Hated that this was asked, all these bright lights.
You will not see Eelwe again.
But she forced the words out.
That is why...
She couldn't stop her wobbling lips.
That is why I need you to come with me, instead of fight with your men.
Gavin only stared at her.
Because I need...
Tears slid down her cheeks.
I need you as a distraction. I need you to buy me time to get past his inner defenses.
Just as the battle tomorrow would buy them time. Because Erewhon would go for Gavin first, the human warrior who had been a bastion against the Dark Lord's forces for so long, who had fought him when no other would. Erewhon's hatred for the human prince was rivaled only by his hatred for her father. Gavin studied her for a long moment, then reached to brush her tears away.
He cannot be killed, Elena. You heard what your father's oracle whispered.
She nodded.
I know. And even if we manage to contain him, trap him.
Gavin considered her words.
You know that we are only pushing the war onto someone else, to whoever one day rules these lands.
This war, she said quietly, is but the second movement in a game that has been played since those ancient days across the sea.
We put it off for someone else to inherit if he's freed, and it will not save those soldiers down there from slaughter tomorrow.
If we do not act, there won't be anyone to inherit this war. Elena said. Doubt danced in Gavin's eyes. Even now, she pushed, our magic is failing. Our gods abandoning us, running from us. We have no Fey allies beyond those in my father's army. And their power, like his, is fading. But perhaps, when that third movement comes, perhaps the players and...
Elena said Mala's bloodline can stop this. It runs in both your houses.
The golden eyes were weary. Heavy. He realized what Manon was asking. Aelin had never planned to see Terrison again. She had married Rowan knowing she would have months at best, days at the worst with him. But she would give Terrison a legal king, to hold her territory together. She had made plans for all of them, and none for herself.
The quest does not end here,
Dorian said softly. Manon shook her head, and he knew she meant more than the keys, than the war, as she said.
No, it does not.
He took the keys from her. They throbbed and flickered, warming his palm. A foreign, horrible presence, and yet, all that stood between them and destruction. No, the quest did not end here. Not even close. Dorian slid the keys into his pocket, and the road that now sprawled away before him, curving into unknown, awaiting shadow. It did not frighten him. Chapter 75 Rowan had married Aelin before dawn barely 2 days ago. Adian and Lysandra had been the only witnesses, as they'd awoken the bleary-eyed captain, who married them quickly and quietly and signed a vow of secrecy. They'd had 15 minutes in their cabin to consummate that marriage. Adian still carried the formal documents, the captain bearing the duplicates. The princess stared at the stars as if they spoke to her, as if the answer were written there.
"Will my people survive?"
A small, quiet voice.
"I don't know."
"Then I will take the steps for that, too. Unite the rebels while I am in Rifthold. Ready the continent for war." Nehemia lowered her eyes from the stars. Elena wanted to fall to her knees before the young princess, beg her forgiveness.
"One of them must be ready to do what needs to be done," Elena said, if only because it was the sole way to explain, to apologize.
Nehemia swallowed.
"Then I shall help in whatever way I can. For Irelia and my people."
Chapter 66. Adian Ashriver had been trained to kill men and hold a line in battle since he was old enough to lift a sword. Crown Prince Ro Galathinius had begun his training personally, holding Adian to standards that some might have deemed unfair, too unyielding for a boy. But Ro had known, Adian realized, as he stood on the prow of the ship, Ansel of Briarcliff's men armed and ready behind him. Ro had known even then that Adian would serve Aelin, and when foreign armies challenged the might of the Firebringer, it might not be mere mortals that he faced. Ro, Evelyn, had gambled that the immortal army now stretching away before him would one day come to these shores, and they had wanted to ensure that Adian was ready when it did.
"Shields up!" Adian ordered the men.
On Perelandra, his own intuition had been not that no temptation must occur, but that this can't go on. This stopping of a third-degree solicitation, already more than once refused, was a problem to which the terrestrial fall offered no clue. A new task, and for that new task a new character in the drama, who appeared, most unfortunately, to be himself. In vain did his mind hark back time after time to the Book of Genesis, asking, what would have happened? But to this the darkness gave him no answer. Patiently and inexorably it brought him back to the here and the now, and to the growing certainty of what was here and now demanded. Almost he felt that the words "would have happened" were meaningless, mere invitations to wander in what the lady would have called an alongside world which had no reality. Only the actual was real, and every actual situation was new. Here, in Perelandra, the temptation would be stopped by Ransom, or it would not be stopped at all. The voice, for it was almost with a voice that he was now contending, seemed to create around this alternative an infinite vacancy. This chapter, this page, this very sentence in the cosmic story was utterly and eternally itself. No other passage that had occurred or ever would occur could be substituted for it. He fell back on a different line of defense. How could he fight the immortal enemy? Even if he were a fighting man instead of a sedentary scholar with weak eyes and a baddish wound from the last war, what use was there in fighting it? It couldn't be killed, could it? But the answer was almost immediately plain. Weston's body could be destroyed, and presumably that body was the enemy's only foothold in Perelandra. By that body, when that body still obeyed a human will, it had entered the new world. Expelled from it, it would doubtless have no other habitation. It had entered that body at Weston's own invitation, and without such invitation could enter no other. Ransom remembered that the unclean spirits in the Bible had a horror of being cast out into the deep. And thinking of these things, he perceived at last, with a sinking of heart, that if physical action were indeed demanded of him, it was an action, by ordinary standards, neither impossible nor hopeless. On the physical plane it was one middle-aged, sedentary body against another, and both unarmed, save for fists and teeth and nails. At the thought of these details, terror and disgust overcame him. To kill the thing with such weapons, he remembered his killing of the frog, would be a nightmare. To be killed, who knew how slowly, was more than he could face. That he would be killed, he felt certain. When, he asked, did I ever win a fight in all my life? He was no longer making efforts to resist the conviction of what he must do. He had exhausted all his efforts. The answer was plain beyond all subterfuge. The voice out of the night spoke it to him in such unanswerable fashion that, though there was no noise, he almost felt it must wake the woman who slept close by. He was faced with the impossible. This he must do. This he could not do. In vain he reminded himself of the things that unbelieving boys might at this moment be doing on earth for a lesser cause. His will was in that valley where the appeal to shame becomes useless, nay, makes the valley darker and deeper. He believed he could face the unman with firearms, even that he could stand up unarmed and face certain death if the creature had retained Weston's revolver. But to come to grips with it, to go voluntarily into those dead yet living arms, to grapple with it naked chest to naked chest. Terrible follies came into his mind. He would fail to obey the voice, but it would be all right because he would repent later on when he was back on earth. He would lose his nerve, as St. Peter had done, and be, like St. Peter, forgiven. Intellectually, of course, he knew the answer to these temptations perfectly well. But he was at one of those moments when all the utterances of intellect sound like twice-told tales. Then some crosswind of the mind changed his mood. Perhaps he would fight and win, perhaps not even be badly mauled. But no faintest hint of a guarantee in that direction came to him from the darkness. The future was black as the night itself. "It is not for nothing that you are named Ransom," said the voice. And he knew that this was no fancy of his own. He knew it for a very curious reason, because he had known for many years that his surname was derived not from Ransom, but from Ranulf's son. It would never have occurred to him thus to associate the two words. To connect the name Ransom with the act of ransoming would have been for him a mere pun. But even his voluble self did not now dare to suggest that the voice was making a play upon words. All in a moment of time he perceived that what was, to human philologists, a merely accidental resemblance of two sounds, was in truth no accident. The whole distinction between things accidental and things designed, like the distinction between fact and myth, was purely terrestrial. The pattern is so large that within the little frame of earthly experience there appear pieces of it between which we can see no connection, and other pieces between which we can. Hence we rightly, for our use, distinguish the accidental from the essential. But step outside that frame, and the distinction drops down into the void, fluttering useless wings. He had been forced out of the frame, caught up into the larger pattern. He knew now why the old philosophers had said that there is no such thing as chance or fortune beyond the moon. Before his mother had borne him, before his ancestors had been called ransoms, before ransom had been the name for a payment that delivers, before the world was made, all these things had so stood together in eternity that the very significance of the pattern at this point lay in their coming together in just this fashion. And he bowed his head and groaned and repined against his fate. To be still a man, and yet to be forced up into the metaphysical world to enact what philosophy only thinks. "My name also is Ransom," said the voice. It was some time before the purport of this saying dawned upon him. He whom the other worlds call Maleldil was the world's ransom, his own ransom, well he knew. But to what purpose was it said now? Before the answer came to him, he felt its insufferable approach and held out his arms before him as if he could keep it from forcing open the door of his mind. But it came. So that was the real issue. If he now failed, this world also would hereafter be redeemed. If he were not the ransom, another would be. Yet nothing was ever repeated, not a second crucifixion, perhaps, who knows, not even a second incarnation. Some act of even more appalling love, some glory of yet deeper humility. For he had seen already how the pattern grows, and how from each world it sprouts into the next through some other dimension. The small external evil which Satan had done in Malacandra was only as a line. the deeper evil he had done in Earth was as a square. If Venus fell, her evil would be a cube, her redemption beyond conceiving. Yet redeemed she would be. He had long known that great issues hung on his choice. But as he now realized the true width of the frightful freedom that was being put into his hands, a width to which all merely spatial infinity seemed narrow, he felt like a man brought out under naked heaven, on the edge of a precipice, into the teeth of a wind that came howling from the pole. He had pictured himself, till now, standing before the Lord, like Peter. But it was worse. He sat before him like Pilate. It lay with him to save or to spill. His hands had been reddened, as all men's hands have been, in the slaying before the foundation of the world. Now, if he chose, he could dip them again in the same blood. "Mercy," he groaned, and then, "Lord, why me?" But there was no answer. The thing still seemed impossible. But gradually something happened to him which had happened to him only twice before in his life. It had happened once while he was trying to make up his mind to do a very dangerous job in the last war. It had happened again while he was screwing his resolution to go and see a certain man in London, and make to him an excessively embarrassing confession which justice demanded. In both cases the thing had seemed a sheer impossibility. He had not thought but known that, being what he was psychologically incapable of doing it. And then, without any apparent movement of the will, as objective and unemotional as the reading on a dial, there had arisen before him, with perfect certitude, the knowledge, "About this time tomorrow you will have done the impossible." The same thing happened now. His fear, his shame, his love, all his arguments were not altered in the least. The thing was neither more nor less dreadful than it had been before. The only difference was that he knew, almost as a historical proposition, that it was going to be done. He might beg, weep, or rebel, might curse or adore, sing like a martyr or blaspheme like a devil. It made not the slightest difference. The thing was going to be done. There was going to arrive, in the course of time, a moment at which he would have done it. The future act stood there, fixed and unalterable, as if he had already performed it. It was a mere irrelevant detail that it happened to occupy the position we call future, instead of that which we call past. The whole struggle was over, and yet there seemed to have been no moment of victory. You might say, if you liked, that the power of choice had been simply set aside, and an inflexible destiny substituted for it. On the other hand, you might say that he had been delivered from the rhetoric of his passions and had emerged into unassailable freedom. Ransom could not, for the life of him, see any difference between these two statements. Predestination and freedom were apparently identical. He could no longer see any meaning in the many arguments he had heard on this subject. No sooner had he discovered that he would certainly try to kill the unman tomorrow than the doing of it appeared to him a smaller matter than he had supposed. He could hardly remember why he had accused himself of megalomania when the idea first occurred to him. It was true that if he left it undone, Maleldil himself would do some greater thing instead. In that sense, he stood for Maleldil. But no more than Eve would have stood for him by simply not eating the apple, or than any man stands for him in doing any good action. As there was no comparison in person, so there was none in suffering, or only such comparison as may be between a man who burns his finger putting out a spark and a fireman who loses his life in fighting a conflagration because that spark was not put out. He asked no longer, "Why me?" It might as well be he as another. It might as well be any other choice as this. The fierce light which he had seen resting on this moment of decision rested in reality on all. "I have cast your enemy into sleep," said the voice. "He will not wake till morning. Get up, walk 20 paces back into the wood, there sleep. Your sister sleeps also." Chapter 12. When some dreaded morning comes, we usually wake fully to it at once. Ransom passed with no intermediate stages from dreamless sleep to a full consciousness of his task. He found himself alone, the island gently rocking on a sea that was neither calm nor stormy. The golden light, glinting through indigo trunks of trees, told him in which direction the water lay. He went to it and bathed. Then, having landed again, he lay down and drank.
He stood for a few minutes, running his hands through his wet hair and stroking his limbs. Looking down at his own body, he noticed how greatly the sunburn on one side and the pallor on the other had decreased. He would hardly be christened Piebald if the lady were now to meet him for the first time. His colour had become more like ivory, and his toes, after so many days of nakedness, had begun to lose the cramped, squalid shape imposed by boots. Altogether he thought better of himself as a human animal than he had done before. He felt pretty certain that he would never again wield an unmaimed body until a greater morning came for the whole universe, and he was glad that the instrument had been thus tuned up to concert pitch before he had to surrender it. "When I wake up after thy image, I shall be satisfied," he said to himself. Presently he walked into the woods. Accidentally, for he was at the moment intent on food, he blundered through a whole cloud of the arboreal bubbles. The pleasure was as sharp as when he had first experienced it, and his very stride was different as he emerged from them. Although this was to be his last meal, he did not even now feel it proper to look for any favourite fruit. But what met him was gourds. "A good breakfast on the morning you're hanged," he thought whimsically, as he let the empty shell drop from his hand, filled for the moment with such pleasure as seemed to make the whole world a dance. "All said and done," he thought, "it's been worth it. I have had a time. I have lived in paradise." He went a little farther in the wood, which grew thickly hereabout, and almost tripped over the sleeping form of the lady. It was unusual for her to be sleeping at this time of the day, and he assumed it was Maleldil's doing. "I shall never see her again," he thought, "and then I shall never again look on a female body in quite the same way as I look on this." As he stood looking down on her, what was most with him was an intense and orphaned longing that he might, if only for once, have seen the great mother of his own race thus, in her innocence and splendour. "Other things, other blessings, other glories," he murmured, "but never that, never in all worlds that. God can make good use of all that happens, but the loss is real." He looked at her once again, and then walked abruptly past the place where she lay. "I was right," he thought. "It couldn't have gone on. It was time to stop it." It took him a long time, wandering like this, in and out of the dark yet coloured thickets, before he found his enemy. He came on his old friend, the dragon, just as he had first seen it, coiled about the trunk of a tree. But it also was asleep. And now he noticed that ever since he awoke he had perceived no chattering of birds, no rustling of sleek bodies or peering of brown eyes through the leafage, nor heard any noise but that of water. It seemed that the Lord God had cast that whole island, or perhaps that whole world, into deep sleep. For a moment this gave him a sense of desolation, but almost at once he rejoiced that no memory of blood and rage should be left imprinted in these happy minds. After about an hour, suddenly rounding a little clump of bubble trees, he found himself face to face with the unman. "Is it wounded already?" he thought, as the first vision of a blood-stained chest broke on him. Then he saw that, of course, it was not its own blood. A bird, already half-plucked and with beak wide open in the soundless yell of strangulation, was feebly struggling in its long, clever hands. Ransom found himself acting before he knew what he had done. Some memory of boxing at his preparatory school must have awaked, for he found he had delivered a straight left with all his might on the unman's jaw. But he had forgotten that he was not fighting with gloves. What recalled him to himself was the pain as his fist crashed against the jawbone. It seemed almost to have broken his knuckles, and the sickening jar all up his arm. He stood still for a second under the shock of it, and this gave the unman time to fall back about 6 paces. It, too, had not liked the first taste of the encounter. It had apparently bitten its tongue, for blood came bubbling out of the mouth when it tried to speak. It was still holding the bird. "So you mean to try strength?" it said in English, speaking thick. "Put down that bird," said Ransom. "But this is very foolish," said the young man. "Do you not know who I am?" "I know what you are," said Ransom, "which of